Hey, it's Steve Imke. In the summer of 2017, I had the opportunity to spend a few hours with a class full of business entrepreneurs that wanted to learn how to conduct strategic planning for their business using the Business Model Canvas. I'm sorry you didn't make it, and I hope this is the next best thing. Here are excerpts from this live event. Hope you enjoy it and find it informative. But even more important, I hope it inspires you to get off the couch and do something with it. Thanks for listening.
Now, in most literature that you will read out there, that Alexander Osterwalder, who originally came up with this concept of the Business Model Canvas, most of it ends right here. And people say, now I'm going to be able to go ahead and I'm going to be able to deploy my business model. But I believe that there's some other pieces that actually are engaged in there, and I'd like to talk about those next. There are external factors now that affect your business model. So everything that we've talked to this point are things that I personally can control, but now we're going to start talking about things that I can no longer control. So the first one we're going to talk about is market forces. So within the market forces, there's a few bullet points here that I'd like to kind of discuss. First of all, let's think about it in terms of market issues. Has anybody heard of a gentleman by the name of Harry Dent? One person. Harry Dent is an economist, and he looks at people's buying habits. So a good example, first off, is who buys minivans? Soccer moms, exactly. Or what does that really equate to? 20-somethings with families. Do seniors buy minivans? They could, but they generally don't. So there's an apex, if you will, of the purchasers that one could define with respect to the customer segment that would say these are 20-somethings, they're married, they probably have children, so on and so forth, and that's what drives them to that. So those are market issues that may happen. So one of those might be related to age distribution. And we're going to talk, so these all kind of interrelate a little bit. So we'll talk about age distribution. You know, everybody's familiar with the baby boom generation. And as the baby boom, which represented a 20% premium over the population that occurred before it and after it, so there's really this big bubble that kind of went through. And what I often try to explain to people is that when that bubble goes through a situation like that minivan scenario, minivan sales take off. As a motorcycle guy, quite frankly, when the baby boomers, who, by the way, motorcycle sales generally occur between mid-40s and about 49 or 50, a little bit on the fringes, but that is a huge spike. And when you take a look at the age population as it went through that, Harley-Davidson, you know, big American motorcycle companies, profits were soaring. They couldn't even, I mean, you had to buy a motorcycle. I can remember, you know, you might take a 2-year wait list to go get that bike and do that. Now, the showroom stocked with bikes, they're discounted value. You know, Harley's suffering some issues because, quite frankly, that baby boom generation's kind of gone out. So there's a predictability that you can actually have based upon, like Harry Dent and purchasing and what he calls demand curves, as you kind of drive down there. So there's a market issue. So market segmentation. So within market segmentation, everyone here have a library card? Right, because if you don't have a library card, I would definitely encourage you to go get that. But I want to talk to you about a tool in there called Business Decisions. And if you go to Steve Biz Blog and you go to the Resources tab, you can actually download both that demand curve thing I just talked about from Harry Dent. But what I'd like to tell you is there is a tapestry segment manual that goes with this Business Decisions, which is very difficult to find. It's a PDF file that's in there, and then you can just download that PDF file from stevebizblog.com as well. But what happens is it breaks the planet, or I should not say the planet, the American population into what they call segments. And each one of these segments has unique demographic and psychographic tendencies. And we all are familiar with the demographic things, right? How old are they? What is their income levels? What's their gender, race issues, that kind of thing. Cycle graphics is another way to kind of measure this, and this is how whenever you use a debit card, credit card, or a loyalty card, when you make a purchase, the UPC code and your billing address on those makes a connection, and at some point, big data out there knows whether you like to buy single-ply or double-ply toilet paper, and whether you like to buy 12-roll packs or 24-roll packs. So quite frankly, this is where we start to look at some of the cycle graphics kind of a thing. And so what Business Decisions has done is they have created what they call these segment codes, and then they give you demographic information and psychographic capabilities or tendencies that these segments have, and that is a really good way to help target. Because quite frankly, if you said, I'm going after what we call Main Street USA kind of people, you can literally get a heat map of anywhere you want, and it'll show you where the highest density is of households that fit that demographic, that segment, if you will, which includes both the demographic and the psychographic elements. The next part of your decision, as you look at that, is that something that's growing or shrinking? So in the Harley example I just gave, and you're looking just generally because I'm a mass market, I'm not a niche market, I'm not trying to sell just in Colorado Springs, I'm selling across the United States. I know that baby boom generation has kind of fallen off. Is that market growing or shrinking? That's shrinking. That should be something that you should understand. Then that kind of ties into some things like needs and demands that people have with respect to the different market forces. The other major part is switching costs. Is it painful to switch, and are there many substitutes? So originally, when invisible fencing kind of came out, there was no switching costs. There was no substitutes for that. Quite frankly, after the patent ran out, everybody else came in with lower cost products, and there were many substitute products. But quite frankly, if you owned an invisible fence, you needed a new receiver, you couldn't go to Radio Fence and say, I want to buy a receiver, because there was a switching cost. You had to replace your transmitter as well as your receiver because they weren't talking on the same frequencies. You see what I'm getting toward? Now, I often tell a story about when I was new to business, I found an accountant. Actually, she was the only accountant that would talk to me as a startup. So she convinced me to buy this accounting software called CBS. Well, we have to understand this was back in the days of character cell and that kind of stuff. There was no really ubiquitous QuickBooks out there for accounting software like there is today. So I said, hey, you use CBS, there's a client version that I had, and then her server version or whatever that she had there, and we could change files back and forth, and it was pretty cool for the day. But what I discovered was a year or so after working with her, I thought, you know what, I really don't like working with this lady anymore. I really think I need to go open my eyes and see if I can't work with another accountant now that I got my business up and running. You know what, I was so committed to that CBS software, I went to every other accounting firm out there and I said, hey, I use CBS. They went, CB what? And so needless to say, I was locked in to her, and I had to kind of grin and bear it because, quite frankly, I had a switching cost there. Even though I had opportunities, substitutes, I could have switched to other accounting software, but the costs to do that were so high. If you remember back in the old days when you had a cell phone, you had that number with a provider, and if you wanted to switch providers, it just wasn't going to happen. Right, you own that. Today, we start to bring down a lot of those barriers, and people are sitting like T-Mobile. People says, hey, no problem, we'll buy you out of that contract and take your phone, the whole number, and everything else like that. All you got to do is come over to us. Everything. So now people are actually using, as part of their business model, essentially a way to eliminate switching costs for you to go ahead and make a different decision. And then, of course, we talk, finally, with respect to market forces, is the revenue attractiveness of a particular market. Is this something that I can leech a lot of margin out of because it's very unique and there's not a lot of other options for these people, so I can charge a premium price for that? Or is it something that people are very price sensitive, and you know, we're talking about price elasticity. In other words, I cannot really effectually change my price very much without causing lots of changes that are going to occur in my particular ecosystem. In addition to market forces, there are key trends that are also occurring out there that change things. So with respect to technology, things that I see right now as I put together this presentation are things like autonomous vehicles, the drones out there, the internet. And so recently I had a package delivered to my house, and I struck up a conversation with the delivery guy, and I said, you know, your job is going to be changing here relatively soon. And he said, how so? And I said, you know, here it is. You drive this big brown truck around, you stop at everybody's driveway, you run up the driveway, you deliver the packages, whatever the case may be. I said, in the future, I said, you're probably going to be relegated to the back of this truck. I said, your job will literally be not to drive that truck, because you'll be on an automated path that will be automated, you know, drive you to some parking lot somewhere. Your job will be filling drone, you know, grippers with various packages and programming them with various addresses. I said, you're going to come to some stop on the corner. You're going to retract the roof of your UPS truck, and out of this thing is like, you know, the Wizard of Oz, the monkeys flying out of the castle. These drones are going to be leaving, delivering all these packages, while you're sitting out there sorting the next set of packages as the drones return, and you're going to start programming them once all your drones return to close the roof, and, you know, as you move to the next location, you're going to continue to work there. So these are technological things that actually can change a particular market. Regulatory issues are another one. One of the reasons I shared earlier about this whole oil and gas thing was because one of the things that I also saw, not only did I see this pain that people are going through having to explain various aspects that didn't differentiate their particular product and slowed their sales process down, but there was a regulatory change that was coming. And so to kind of put a little bit of background on this, prior to the president signing the Jobs Bill, which was intended to provide crowdfunding to businesses to kind of get them up and running, one of the things that the Jobs Bill had to do was get away from what they called the general solicitation rule. So for years, the Security and Exchange Commission said, if you have an oil and gas business and you're looking for investors, you must find people who are what we call accredited investors to invest in your particular program. Because if they're accredited, we figure they're savvy financially enough that you're not going to go ahead and bilk them out of their money. So we're going to limit the number of people that you can sell to that are not accredited investors to go out there. But if I was going to sell an interest in my particular company through a Jobs Bill, I needed to be able to solicit people, and in the old days I couldn't solicit them because I had to have a relationship with them prior. And so when that came out, all of a sudden, ding, 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 light started going off. I said, hey, within the oil and gas business, it's a very tight group. The only people who are investing in new oil and gas programs is, in fact, people that are insiders, people who already have a high net worth, and more importantly, are already in that particular industry. I said, now, with the regulatory change, these oil and gas companies will literally be able to say, hey, guess what? I get this oil well I want to drill. Would you like to be party to that? Look, the rich people make lots of money on oil and gas. Why wouldn't you? So there was this huge educational bubble that was going to happen because only a very small subset of the world even understood what it was like to drill a hole for oil and gas. Now there's going to be this whole new market. I said, you know what? Double jeopardy for me. I'm thinking I'm going to double down on this. It's even more important. So here, sometimes a regulatory change can literally change, you know, the complexion of your particular business and the future kind of going forward. So import, export fees. So we just had a new presidential election. How is that going to affect that? Are we going to be more insulative? Are we going to be more open? You know, there's been issues about like the NAFTA trade agreement and the Pacific PAC agreement, those types of things. And as those things were in place, those things changed. If you were an import exporter, those had some rather significant implications to you. Taxes are another one. If I increase taxes or decrease taxes, that implies more investing or less investing in a particular business and may change how I look at things. So I began to buy real estate when taxes became a big problem for me because it came with a tax consequence or a tax avoidance technique to go off and do that. I invested in oil and gas as a result of a tax rules. The higher the taxes are, the more it creates a sucking sound into going investing in certain types of things, you know, that are more tax advantaged. So these are trends. Again, you can't control any of these. These are external things. They're social or cultural things. Wealth distribution. Again, part of that whole deal with the jobs bill was effectively there to try to close that gap between the rich and the poor. Because if you sat there and people would look at it and say, why are the rich continue to make money versus the poor not so much? Well, the rich were getting invested in companies that were going public or investing in businesses that, you know, startup businesses because they were accredited investors that allowed them to get dividend income, where somebody who was living paycheck to paycheck wasn't able to do that. Similar things, I can even go back to housing and how housing, the home mortgage deduction piece actually, you know, was again a government regulatory piece to get people to actually buy into buying homes as opposed to renting them, because that's how they kind of figured they would make money and, again, work on that wealth distribution thing. So you can see how external factors might affect that. Discretionary income that people have is also a key factor that fits in there. And of course, we had talked about some of the demand curves again with where people are age-wise and as it goes through those different baby boom generations. And I would add that this is not only global, but it's also local. One would argue that the median age of somebody who lives in Boca Raton is not the same age as somebody in Silicon Valley, right? I mean, much more younger population in Silicon Valley, much more retired people, let's say, in Boca Raton. So they're regional as well as national kind of trends that you have to deal with. Socioeconomic, again, I have kids that are kind of in that marrying stage. When I was a kid, I mean, if you were 20 years old and you weren't married, that was wow, what's wrong with you? But now, if you take a look at the average age, I mean, boys don't get married till 29 years old, and women not till 27. I mean, so it's a bit of a shift there. So how does that affect? If I'm a wedding planner, for crying out loud, that has some rather significant elements to how I'm going to go ahead and look at that, some key trends that go in there. Living arrangements is another one. When I was a kid, for example, it was very common for elderly people to live with their kids, quite frankly. I tried that. It didn't work so well for me. You know, my mom lives in an independent living facility right now because I couldn't put two hens in the same house, if you know what I'm saying. So, you know, race density also changes things. So sometimes we have changes in our ecosystems that go ahead and affect us. So again, key trends, things I can't necessarily control.
Thank you for listening to Strategic Planning Using the Business Model Canvas. To learn more about Stephen Imke or to learn more about what it takes to own and operate a small business, please visit stevebizblog.com. That's stevebizblog.com. Or look for Steve's many books on various aspects of small business ownership at amazon.com or on stevebizblog.com.